Welcome to another episode of Code for Thought. In this episode, I want to tell you about an organization I came across last year, Lecturers Without Borders. And why talk about them? Because as a researcher or research software engineer, you probably did some teaching and tutoring yourself. But Lecturers Without Borders go a step further and want to share our work and knowledge in schools, and in schools across the globe. Which is a pretty ambitious goal for sure, but when you consider that many, or at least some of us, travel to conferences, workshops and meetings, it kind of makes sense. Going into schools and talking about your research and work can be a tall order. I tried it myself a number of years ago and let's just say I didn't exactly shine. Which is all the more reasons to have a lot of respect for scientists and research software engineers that do dedicate their time and effort. Which brings me to Eugenia Covington. Eugenia is leading this non-profit organization, and as a virologist by training, she got involved in Lecturers Without Borders during the pandemic years, as she will explain in my conversation with her.
Hi, my name is Eugenia. I am originally from Argentina, but I have been living abroad, first in South Korea, then in France, and now in the UK, for over 10 years. I have a PhD in virology, but I currently work on science communication, mostly teaching and coaching scientists on how to present their research to different audiences and in different formats. And since early 2022, I also run the nonprofit organization Lecturers Without Borders.
Exactly. And that brings us right to the subject of today, Lecturers Without Borders. So what exactly is it and what's the mission of that organization? It's a non-profit organization.
Exactly. Isn't it? So Lecturers Without Borders is a network of scientists that volunteer their time to give science outreach lectures in schools around the world. It started in 2017 when a group of friends, they were all doing their PhDs or postdocs, and they realized that during their research, they were traveling a lot to attend conferences, workshops, events, and also to visit their families because they were living somewhere else. And they thought this could be a very good opportunity to meet local students, to share their knowledge, to share their science, and also bring maybe a topic that would normally not be taught in schools because some of them were doing things like particle physics. It's not something that kids learn in school, but at the same time, really. It could potentially motivate someone, a kid that could be interested in this, to learn that this exists, to learn that this could be a career for them, and to show them also like real life examples of people doing this. So overall, the mission today of Lecturers Without Borders is to bring high quality science to schools around the world and present students with real life examples of how this can turn into a career. Regardless of the economic situation of the school, because that was the other thing. Sometimes some schools have more means to bring a scientist to their classroom than others. So in a way, the idea of them being free and being like completely free of charge for the school and being volunteer work of the scientists means it's more democratic and it can reach all the schools, regardless of how much money they have.
How many lecturers do you have? Is there a fixed number of lecturers or does this vary?
No, so lecturers can register in our website. There's peak moments when we had a lot of registrations. By now, it's more or less stabilized at around 430 people.
Oh, wow.
It sometimes oscillates. Most people join and then never leave, luckily. But we did have a few scientists that for reasons of like changing jobs or doing something that was like, I definitely cannot volunteer anymore. So it sort of stabilized around that number. So we are around 430 people by now.
This leads us to the next question that I have. How does it actually work from a logistics point of view? So how do you organize getting a lecturer into a school A and what countries do you operate in?
The way it started and the way it sort of aims to continue is by contacting schools through direct contacts. We have scientists, for example, I am from Argentina. And if some other scientist in a network says they're going to Argentina, I can try to, even if I'm not from the same city, I can try to see if any of my contacts knows any school in a specific region. And then we also have this database of schools that we can email and say, okay, I know that you are not in this city, but are you by any chance in contact with anyone from this other city? This is how we reach schools. Sometimes when we cannot reach them like this, we email them directly. The problem with emailing schools that are not in our database and we don't have direct contacts with is they tend not to respond because they really don't know who we are. So in general, we try to work through word of mouth, which sometimes might not be the most efficient way, because it might be that by the time we reach the school, the scientists already went there and they are back. Or the scientist is traveling during holidays, school holidays. So then the school will say, I would be happy to, but not now. And then at least this contact is made for a future occasion. So it might be that our success rate is not ideal in terms of how many scientists tell us they're going and how many we manage to organize lectures for. But we do establish a network that then we can continue providing lectures for in different formats whenever somebody else comes, or offering them a webinar instead, or all these types of alternatives, because sometimes we organize other types of projects. I can tell you more about it if you want to.
Do you contact the schools? And if so, how do you find them? Or do schools have a way of contacting you? But then the question is, how would they find out that Lecturers Without Borders exists?
Yeah, so both work. For example, today, earlier this morning, I had a meeting with someone from Egypt that found about us because of somebody else mentioning it, that they had had this webinar and they mentioned this, and the school, the teacher was saying, like, I've heard that you do webinars, do you do something else? And then I said, okay, let's discuss it. And we might start a new project now in Egypt because of this school, because they were organizing an event. Another way in which we reach a lot of schools are other associations of schools. So there's educational associations in many, many countries that either are related or not to the Ministry of Education of the country. Some of them are very informal, things like the Association of Catholic Schools in some country, or the actual Minister of Education, that in some countries are the contacts that we have, or associations that are related to a specific topic. There's one organization called Scientix that works in Europe, throughout Europe, and they are specifically in touch with science teachers all across Europe. So if we are looking for a school in a country, we might tell them, like, okay, this is a European country. Do you have contacts in that country? And is these intermediary organizations that sometimes help us? So in terms of us reaching out to them, it could be like this, but also these organizations are the ones that talk about us. So for example, Scientix has this annual event, online event, in which they present different projects, and they have invited us to talk about Lectures Without Borders several times. We appear on the website. So if somebody goes into the website of this organization, they will find ours. And that's how a lot of schools end up reaching us. So it is a two-way communication, I would say. Sometimes we are the ones reaching out to schools, like I said, through other schools, through organizations, or through our scientists. Sometimes, like I mentioned, the example of me in Argentina, it can be that we reach out to our scientists that are from the UK and say, that's maybe the school where your children go, or where you work, or where your partner works, or do you know any schools in the area that could be willing to do this? And like, this is how we can reach them. But then also they can tell this school about this. We also invite our scientists to tell the teachers of their children that they are volunteering in this organization. If they want to host a lecture, it can be them, or it can be another scientist about another topic. The idea is to reach it also through word of mouth. That is the one that works the best.
Are there any particular geographical areas you focus on, like particular countries or particular continents even?
The answer I would say is yes and no. It's yes because we are lately trying to strengthen our local networks. This is more related to how Lectures Without Borders could evolve. So what's happening right now is this started as a very, very small organization. And since we've been growing so much, we are starting to need more local coordination. And we started as a completely global network, and we still are in a sense. So for example, we didn't really have a lot of schools in Egypt. And now that this school contacted us, of course, we are happy to start doing things in Egypt. So in that sense, we are global. What is not global, as global anymore, is that since we became so big, we are trying to a bit focus on the countries where we already have a network, to try to strengthen that network and then replicate it. Because we found at some point that growing in every direction at the same time was making all the local networks very weak. So in the end, we would have people that would come for one lecture and then maybe never answer emails again. And those are not the type of nodes that we want. We want a network with strong nodes, at least geographically. so that then it's easier to reach when we have somebody going, we know who to contact, for example.
So you mentioned core team and local networks, so which brings us to a different level of the organization. So we talked about how schools and you are getting in touch with each other and how the scientists may reach out to you and the schools directly. But how does the organization itself work? So you mentioned a core team and then local networks. So could you draw a picture for us?
Yes. So the team, by now, the team is very, very dispersed. It's not a team anymore, which is a good thing, I would say. So we used to have a small core team that actually still appears on our website as the team. But in reality, now, luckily, the team is starting to become less of a fixed thing and more of a distributed network of work. Sometime we devoted a lot of time to establishing what the code of conduct for our scientists would be, what would be expected of them, sort of, in a way, rules and regulations of what our activities will be, so that now we can start accepting the offers from our scientists of coordinating the activities. Because at some point, there was this separation between the team and the scientists. And now we're trying to use the presence of the scientists in their countries of residence. For example, if somebody says, I'm going to Spain, then I can contact the scientists in Spain and say, this person is coming to Spain, and sort of forget about it in a way. Like before, it was really just a very small core team contacting everyone. Which meant that sometimes, especially for certain countries, this could create a language barrier, which is not ideal. Because sometimes we had, for example, people going to Romania. We didn't have anyone in the core team speaking Romanian, but many schools in Romania didn't have anyone speaking English. So then we would not have a way to contact them. And we actually do have Romanian scientists. So we were like, okay, how about we ask the Romanian scientists to be the ones that contact the schools? And like this, we get a much higher rate of responses. So in a way, that's what we're trying to do. Continue to decentralize our activities, because at some point we realized that that was the biggest bottleneck for the organization.
So is this something like you have local chapters, I think, for lack of a better word? Okay. So how did you get involved in all of this?
I got involved in early 2020 during the COVID pandemic. So as I I am a virologist, like I mentioned. And at the time, during the COVID pandemic, I happened to be unemployed. So I found myself stuck at home, and I thought I could volunteer and put all this knowledge of virology to a good use. So I contacted Lectures Without Borders. I knew of them because I had briefly worked with one member of Lectures Without Borders. So I contacted them and I asked them if they were organizing lectures about viruses. They said they weren't, but that they would be more than happy to do so. Since I had a lot of time, I actually volunteered to be myself the one organizing the lectures. So we organized a whole series of webinars on viruses and viral diseases with the idea of helping students sort of understand the pandemic and complement the work of the teachers, because the teachers were at that time trying to adapt to online lessons. And of course, it was a high anxiety moment. We were trying to give them also sort of a breathing room and say, okay, today we are going to do the lecture and we are going to do some activity, some interactive activity for the kids to A, learn something useful about the pandemic, and B, also have something different to the usual lectures. So it was a very good opportunity also for me and for the schools and for the other scientists that got involved, because there were many other scientists involved.
But now you're actually leading Lecturers Without Borders, aren't you? So how did that happen then?
So it happened because based on this activity, Lectures Without Borders ended up asking me if I could join as a coordinator for the activities of the organization, which I did. And I worked for more or less a year and a half as a coordinator. And then when Lectures Without Borders got a grant to expand some of their activities towards low and middle income countries, when they got this grant, they were like, okay, for this, since it will be a project that will have, it will be more expensive in terms of time, we will use this grant to actually complement a bit instead of just being volunteer work. They offered to pay me just for the duration of the project. The project by now is over, and then become like a proper CEO of the NGO, which I did. And then by now I just stayed because I really, like, I just fell in love with the mission of the NGO, and it's something I cannot get myself to let go of, which is, I guess, a good thing.
It is a good thing. I'm sure it's good for the organization. So going back to the pandemic, were you actually teaching in Argentina, in your home country, or were you then teaching across the board anywhere? In Spanish, I assume.
No, we were actually doing it in many languages. The webinars that we offered were in German, French, English, and Spanish. I only speak three of those languages.
Well, that's enough.
But I didn't speak a word of German at the time. So yeah, we were doing these webinars basically to whoever was interested. I gave a webinar in India, a webinar in Romania, a webinar in Portugal, one in Spain, one in Colombia, one in Argentina. And then other scientists gave webinars in the UK, in Finland, in Senegal, and in a couple of countries that now escape my mind. But yeah, it was a big project, and it became bigger because actually more moving towards how the pandemic affected lectures at borders. These webinars on virology actually opened the door to a new way of approaching schools. So many of the schools that we already had in our database consider them maybe a good way of presenting their students with new information. And so it allowed us to explore webinars as a way of presenting science to students more in the long term. So it was not only during the pandemic, but we kept doing online activities and we continue. From the point of view of the scientists, it also allowed scientists to give these lectures from their own home. So a lot of scientists that maybe were reluctant to register or had heard about us, but were not sure it would be for them because they didn't maybe traveling in a lot. Or, for example, there was one scientist that joined Lectures Without Borders during the pandemic that said she already had known about Lectures Without Borders, but she had a 6-month-old baby. So she was not traveling anywhere. So she didn't register because she was like, you know, I could in principle do a lecture, but I'm not traveling anywhere and I know I will not be traveling for at least a year more. So the fact that now we are offering the possibility of doing it from their own home is a very good thing. So because of the pandemic, there were some scientific conferences that had to be moved online. So they were supposed to happen in person somewhere and then they had to cancel. And because of that, we had this idea, and it was a collaboration with Europlanet, that is a society in Europe of planetary scientists. They organized this annual conference called Europlanet Science Congress. And we had the idea of opening it to schools. And because it was online, that was easier to do. Because in an in-person event, you need a lot of authorizations from parents to bring the kids. Basically, what we did was we opened the whole conference with, of course, the permission from the speakers and the organizers to high school students. And we also complemented the talks of the conference with outreach talks. So talks that were specifically aimed for young students. This allowed the students not only to learn about planetary sciences, but also to understand what conferences were, why scientists go to conferences, and what's the difference between a scientific talk in a conference and science outreach talk, and basically understand a bit better like science communication. Because of that activity that we did online, we ended up repeating this and opening several different online events to students. And I think this also allowed us to reach more schools, reach students in a different way. We organized art competitions in parallel with this scientific conference. It was interesting in a way to allow students to see a side of science that they usually don't see.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting because we tend to think, and of course it's true, that the pandemic had a very negative effect. It had a very negative effect on a lot of people, not least the schools, because they had to close down in many countries. But in other ways, it opened up new opportunities, like what you just said, that you have webinars. Rather than scientists going to the location itself, into the school, they can do that from the home. And that is good for the scientists, but it's also good for the schools, isn't it? So I guess this is what you continue doing now?
Exactly. So today, our lectures reach students both in person and online. So our website allows scientists to offer webinars for schools. And the schools can view this catalog and request lectures that fit their curriculum. So that is an interesting thing for schools that want to complement something that they are teaching. For example, if we are teaching volcanoes, you can contact someone that is in volcanology, or however you call it, studying volcanoes. And you teach students about volcanoes from someone that is doing that in real life and can show them pictures of when they go take samples or all these things that maybe make it more interesting for the students. But at the same time, the scientists can still let us know. The same scientists that gave a webinar, they can still tell us if they're going in person to a place or if they want to give an in-person lecture in their own town. Both activities, both in person and online, have been combined. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the fact that we have both ends up being a good opportunity for people, for example, schools that are organizing things like hackathons, or we had this project about climate change. And the project about climate change had some online lectures followed by a project that was done by the kids in the school, followed by the teacher, but mentored by scientists. So we had online lectures, in-person scientists, and the teacher doing something, being followed by scientists that were helping them. So it was a really interesting way of mixing the online and the offline. And with scientific conference, it also happened that we continued opening. So for the EPSC, this Europlanet Science Congress that I mentioned, we did one that was hybrid. So the conference was happening in person. We gave some talks that were online to complement the in-person activities. And also the speakers of the conference went to local schools. So in a way, it was a mixture of the schools could watch the streaming of the talks and also have webinars and also have visiting scientists. So it was a bit of a mixture. There was this conference called CSVConf, that is a conference on data science. And what we did was, again, organize like an open event. And the speakers of this conference were visiting local schools and organizing like a speed dating with scientists and things like this that we organized. That was an idea that we had never had before COVID.
I'm just thinking that you can't just walk into a school saying you're a scientist and you want to help out with teaching. So what measures do you have to put into place if teachers were to go into a school in real life or even online? I think that probably the same rules apply. So how do you make sure that there is some safeguards around it?
So I think that is where Lectures Without Borders makes a difference in a way. And the reason why a lot of scientists end up getting involved is because we found a way to give the credibility to the scientists. Mm. So if I were, like you said, to go to a French school and say, hi, I'm a researcher here, I want to organize an activity, they will definitely say no, because they can't. They are legally obliged to say no. But if you say, okay, I am part of this organization, because of being part of this organization, I have agreed to this code of conduct, to this safeguarding policy, because we have a very strong child safeguarding policy, and these are the procedures, these are the rules of what can and cannot happen. For example, we have very strict rule of the children cannot contact the scientist after the talk without the teacher being in copy. So if they want to ask a follow-up question, if they want to, I don't know, somehow be in touch because they found their topic very interesting, it's all very good because it shows motivation from the children. But the teacher has to always be in copy. And one thing that we ask our scientists when they register, they have to sign this commitment that if any person that is a minor contacts them through any way and the teacher is not in copy, they have to notify us and they have to notify the teacher. So if, for example, a student, 16-year-old, finds the researcher on social media and contacts them, they have signed this agreement saying that they will let the teacher know and that they will let the organization know. The idea is to make sure that no one creates any problem in any way, because it can be really just a student asking a question through social media, which is perfectly valid. But this is a minor and we cannot really be dealing with minors without all these safeguarding policies. This also like reassures the school. We managed to get the authorization from the schools in certain countries, like you were mentioning in the UK. We usually work with people in the government, minor agencies that regulate this. So we try to say like, okay, we want to get this permission for organizing lectures in this school. We cannot really give you a specific date because it will depend on the availability of the scientists and of the school. But is it in principle okay if a person from this organization comes? And that is how some countries end up allowing the public schools to receive our scientists. This is where being in an organization like Lectures Without Borders helps.
And is necessary, I guess. Yeah. So the one question that we haven't touched on yet is the age group of the students. The other question that I have is which scientific area? We had planet science, we had physics, we had virology, you're a virologist. But is it really truly across the board, or do you focus on specific areas?
So in terms of topics, I would say it's across the board. We do have people doing social sciences. We have people doing psychology, sociology. We have people doing even geography or history. So in that sense, it's across the board. In terms of age, We do allow from time to time elementary school kids, but very, very rarely. Most of our lectures are for high school, sometimes middle school in countries that have a middle school. I would say ideal age would be between 15 and 18. Sometimes we have a 13 to 15. And we do have a couple of schools that, it's funny because the reason why we sometimes allow younger schools is sort of historical. One of the first few schools that we visited were elementary schools. It happened to be that this one particular school had a level of knowledge of science that was pretty impressive. We had 8-year-old kids asking questions like, how do you know that this DNA is not recombinant? And you're like, what? How do,
wow.
How do you know that? Like, so it was really, really completely crazy. So in those cases, we are like, okay, if you are a school that is specifically oriented towards science and you know that your kids will understand the basics, then I think it's a good idea. Or from time to time, we organize big events that are very, very basic in terms of the level of the science, let's say. But we do it because we have a few schools that keep requesting something for the younger kids, in which case we might do it. But in the ideal world, we do it more for older kids because we find that it can be more useful for them in terms of They are starting to wonder what they want to do with their lives. And also because for scientists, it is less work. If you're a scientist that is used to talking to other scientists and suddenly I tell you, okay, you have to talk to a 6-year-old, then the jump that you have to make and the way you have to simplify the topic is way too much. While if I say, okay, you just need to use less jargon and try to speak to a 16 or 17-year-old, you know that there's a lot of words that you can still use. Since the work of our scientists is volunteer, we cannot ask them to devote 3 weeks to preparing a talk. If they can't prepare it in 3 hours, then it's already a lot. They're volunteering a lot of their time.
Okay, I think we're coming close to the end now. So there are two questions. The first is, what's in store for Lecturers Without Borders in future?
Wow, I wish I had the answer. Our aim, like I said, is really to move towards a fully decentralized model. We find that one of the biggest bottlenecks in growth of these types of organization is that if you become dependent on grants and on paying everyone that works, it becomes unsustainable and it's impossible to grow because you end up sort of being constricted by the rules and the regulations of the people that gave you the grant. I mean, this is maybe a more particularly me. I'm not a huge fan also of like these big philanthropic organizations because if you depend too much on one organization, you end up being a bit of just part of them. And I wouldn't want Lectures Without Borders to lose this grassroots idea. Like we were scientists that were doing this. We are not part of a bigger organization. So in a way, in that sense, I think our biggest challenge right now is decentralizing. And like I said, strengthening the local hubs and formalizing these local hubs so that we can replicate this. And if I may squeeze in my biggest project is we have this project that is called Women in STEM. We want to do a competition in schools in which they have to identify local women working in STEM subjects. And it is a competition across within the class, but also eventually one day it will be a global competition on between schools as well. And the idea will be, yes, to on the one hand, give visibility to women working in STEM, but also to provide kids with the challenge of having to communicate science, which it's a really interesting topic. And I'm just a huge fan of science communication, so that's it.
Me likewise, yeah. The final question, how do people get in touch if I was interested? How would I go about it?
Great. So we have our website. If you put Lectures Without Borders in Google, it will probably appear, hopefully. So it's levibo.org, which is levibo.org. So it's the first two letters of each word. So levibo.org, and then you can join our network. It clearly has a big sign that says join a network, and then you can choose if you're a scientist, school, or a partner. Partners could be other organizations that want to help us reach more schools or more scientists. Then you just fill a registration form and you will start receiving documentation that you need to read and agree, and guides to how to get involved and how to volunteer if you want to volunteer more. And all these things happen afterwards. So basically, just go to levibo.org and register.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm really excited about this project. I think it's great. And I wish you all the best for the future. I'm sure there's going to be a bright future ahead, Eugenia.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about this project that I like so much.
The episode notes have the link to the website of Lecturers Without Borders. Why not check them out if you want to find out more? As Eugenia mentioned, you can register there directly if you're interested in joining the network. Oh, time's up. See you next time. But before I forget, this podcast is covered by the Creative Commons license. See ya!